We value your suggestions and observations as we embark on this vital mission. Email your tips to wpfw.lsb.relocation@gmail.com. And thanks for all you do to nourish and sustain WPFW, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice. Bye.
I'm Candy Shannon, and you are tuned to member-supported WPFW, Washington.
From WPFW News in Washington, this is Monday Morning QB, a news program with a point of view. Today is Monday, April 22nd, 2024. I'm Sue Goodwin.
And I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Today on the show, D.C. teachers speak out against austerity and budget choices in the district.
What does it say about us as a people and as a society that there's no problem spending money on sports teams, but we have no value for what is really our treasure, and that's our children?
Plus, making democracy stronger by allowing the public to decide how to spend public money.
All that and more. Stay with us. Earlier this month, Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser unveiled a budget proposal for the next fiscal year, envisioning sweeping cuts to local spending in response to a large projected deficit. The cuts, while presented as a shared sacrifice, have faced criticism from grassroots activists for targeting social programs important to low-income families. Particularly, education in the district would take a hit under Bowser's proposal. The Washington Teachers Union, which represents thousands of district educators, says Bowser's proposed budget could cut over 250 teaching positions in a process called excessing. That staffing cut, combined with substantial pay cuts for early childhood educators and effective tax hikes for working families, could greatly disrupt the learning process for D.C. youth. The teachers' union is also facing delays in negotiating a labor contract it says is long overdue, causing even greater uncertainty in schools. To better understand the teacher perspective on Bowser's proposed budget, and for an update on bargaining, Monday Morning QB was joined by Jacqueline Pogue-Lyons, president of the Washington Teachers Union. President Pogue-Lyons began by talking about the threat of losing hundreds of teachers.
These teachers could be excessed by the end of the school year, which to me, especially because it could happen in wards 8, that's like the number one most targeted ward to lose a lot of teachers, followed by ward 3. In schools like Deal and schools like Jackson Reed, they have the most middle school students and the most high school students in the city. We've been talking to middle school teachers at Deal. It could particularly hit hard there. And like I said, they're the school that has the most middle school students in the city. And to think about a school that has so many students losing teachers is just, you can't wrap your head around it, especially as a teacher reminded me, they felt like they were trying to make strides and gains since COVID. And now with these losses and the potential of teachers being excess, gains that we made, we could now lose. Needless to say, the stress that it puts on teachers in a school, who is it going to happen to? There's one school in Ward 3, I won't give the name, where I had a meeting with the teachers and you could just see the stress on their faces that says, I don't know if it's going to be me. I don't know if it's going to be my colleague. And just a sense of, do I need to stay in DCPS? Do I need to start looking for positions in another school or possibly in another district? And many of them are thinking about going into another district because having to face this again next year or the year after that is too stressful. And again, I keep saying our teachers are very young. Most of our teachers are in their 30s, many of them in their early 30s. And at that point in your life, you're possibly still paying back student loans, you know, starting a family, possibly thinking about buying a house or car. You don't need the extra or added stress of worrying about whether you're going to have a job or not, especially when we know nationally there's a shortage of teachers. One school that I visited is in Ward 7. There's a possibility of them losing up to 9 staff. And again, Ward 7 is considered in some areas are underserved communities. And this was a middle school. They can't afford to lose 9 teachers. And these, especially in this middle school, these teachers are really dedicated to teaching this at this level and this grade and in this area. And so it just brings, along with not having a contract, then having to worry about the budget, it's not stability for the teaching profession in the district. And although they keep talking about, yes, we did get a contract last year, and that's the narrative that they're creating, that teachers got contracts, administrators got a contract. But I just want to remind people that we had to wait 3.5 years to get that contract.
We last talked back in January about the status of contract negotiations between the WTU and the school district. The main takeaways from that conversation were, one, that the contract was long overdue, and two, that at that point, high-level officials, namely Chancellor Lewis Ferebee, had not yet attended any sessions. It seems like there's been some progress on that, but can you update our listeners as to the status of contract negotiations?
Right. Well, we're still overdue. Our contract ended September 30th of 2023. And unfortunately, we wanted to, when we were in contract negotiations the year before last, we wanted to extend it because we knew as soon as we got this contract, we'd be right back at the table in less than a year trying to negotiate another one. It didn't happen. It's what the WTU wanted, but it didn't happen. And like we thought was going to happen, we are now have an expired contract. One thing that I would hope for the future of WTU and DCPS is that we stop having these delayed contracts. The last contract took 3.5 years. The one before that took 5 years. I think it makes for financial instability for the city. I also know that it creates instability for our teaching profession because now we don't have a contract and we have an unstable budget and our young teachers are looking at that. So why would I want to come somewhere where there's instability with the budget and definitely instability with the contract? We see that as a form of disrespect for what we do. So we started out slow. I want to keep reminding folks that we started sending our proposals and memorandums of agreement for a new contract to DCPS starting in the spring. And by the end of the summer, they had all our proposals and they had all of our MOAs. We have just 10 proposals and we have just 3 MOAs, memorandums of agreement for safety, for the environment, and for diversity in the school. Not only did we not get a response to our proposals, we also did not get dates. And so when we last talked, we had a date that we circled and were excited about in December. We met. No one from DCPS showed up. Then after that, it became a struggle to get more dates. And because we have a big negotiations team of 25, we didn't want to pull our negotiation team out of the classroom because the people who bargained for the contract on the WTU team are teachers. We wanted to meet after the school day so we didn't have to bring teachers out of the classroom during the day. DCPS refused, and the only times they offered were 5 a.m. in the morning. And unfortunately, we did meet at 5 a.m. in the morning. One time the chancellor showed up, the next time the chancellor didn't show up. Again, we see this as not operating in good faith. And to ask teachers who have to come out and negotiate a contract at 5 a.m. and then those same teachers by 7 a.m. have to leave the negotiating table to go to the schools and teach is another sign of disrespect and not operating in good faith. But I will say we are fortunate that we have city officials who are rallying and supporting us and are sensitive to our plight. The State Board of Ed passed a resolution right away in the fall saying that our contract was important and it needed to be taken care of by the end of the year. And I will definitely say that we've had city council members who have actually come to our negotiating sessions, one of them being Chairman Mendelson. When the chancellor didn't show up at 5 a.m. in the morning, Chairman Mendelson did. He was not happy that the chancellor was not there. And soon after, we stopped meeting at 5. We got an opportunity and more dates to meet at more reasonable times of the day after teachers have finished teaching. And it is moving slow, but we have more meetings and we're now meeting after the school day. One of the biggest problems that we have is, like I said, we gave DCPS 10 proposals and we gave them 3 MOAs. And unfortunately, they finally did give us their proposals, but their proposals that they've given to us are basically trying to take away rights that we've had since 1968 that have to do with class size. They say it's a management right to determine class size. Also, they want to determine when the school day begins, when the school day ends. They say that's a management right. When the school year begins, when the school year ends. So those are certain elements of their proposals that do not tie directly to the students, except increasing class sizes that they want to take away from us. And to me, it says they're not operating in good faith, that they want to drag contract negotiations on and on and on. And that's just a taste of the things that they want to take away from us.
Tying the contract negotiations back to Bowser's budget proposal, given that Bowser's proposed budget directly impacts staffing levels at DC schools, are any of these proposed cuts subject to bargaining with the WTU, or is the union kind of excluded from the budgetary process?
We're excluded from the budgetary process, but what we should be negotiating right now, but we're not, is at the same time they're trying to take away our rights, they're trying to say we don't have any money. What teacher is going to want to come and teach here or stay here if you don't know what the class sizes are going to be like? And then at this point in time, you don't know if you'll receive the compensation that you should rightfully get. And then you don't know from year to year with the instability of the budget, whether you'll have a job, whether you'll be excess. And I want to remind people that teachers had to declare whether they're going to return to DCPS next year by April. And by the end of this month, they have to know. But how do you decide if you're going to come or stay if you don't know that you're going to have a job? So those are all the factors that teachers are faced with. And I've actually, you know, been in meetings where teachers are really grappling with whether they're going to be excess or not. And if you know the accessing process, it can be demeaning and it can take away any morale that you might have for teaching.
One of the other proposed cuts in Bowser's budget is a massive cut to the pay equity fund, which I understand was really successful in boosting pay for early childhood educators in the district. Talk about the importance of education at an early age and how these pay cuts could be really damaging to childhood education in DC.
Right. That was the main part. I had to give testimony in front of the state board, and it appeared that everyone that spoke was talking about the pay equity cut or elimination. I said, not cut, it's just an elimination. And I am an early childhood teacher at heart. That's what I've spent most of my 30 years. I've spent 20 years as a kindergarten teacher. And so I know the importance of early childhood. And we know what the research says, the importance of early childhood in the educational success of children. And again, when you put it all together of what we've been through with COVID, trying to put people and families back together, because in many instances, we didn't know what our families were going through. And our earliest learners who should have been in school, but for COVID, they were at home. So to think that our neediest people and our most underserved people are women who teach in this profession, and they can't know that we're not valuing what they do, and we're not valuing that what they do is touching the future, and that we're already having issues keeping people in the public schools teaching. It's even worse in daycare. And in many ways, they can make more doing other jobs that we used to look down on. But the lowest seems now is in the daycare profession. So especially when this really affects women of color, I can't wrap my head around it. And especially when you compare to what we are about to spend a lot of money on in this city. We're about to spend millions and millions of dollars on sports teams. And I'm not saying that's necessary for the economy of our city, but two things can be true at the same time. And what does it say about us as a people and as a society that there's no problem spending money on sports teams, but we have no value for what is really our treasure, and that's our children?
That's Jacqueline Pogue Lyons, president of the Washington Teachers Union. To learn more, follow the union on X at WTU Teacher. That's at WTU Teacher. For Monday Morning QB, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns.
For Monday Morning QB, I'm Sue Goodwin. There's a movement growing across the globe to use public spending as a way to deepen democracy, build stronger communities, and make public budgets more equitable and effective. It's called participatory budgeting, and it is a form of citizen participation in which local residents are directly involved in the process of deciding how a portion of their local government's budget is actually spent. The New York Times calls participatory budgeting revolutionary civics in action, and the United Nations has called it a best practice of democratic governance. The Participatory Budgeting Project is a Brooklyn-based nonprofit offering support, resources, and guidance to local groups and elected officials organizing participatory budgeting efforts in their communities. Anita Dos Santos currently serves as the advocacy manager at the project, and she joined us to tell us more about this powerful form of public engagement and how it actually works.
So, participatory budgeting, or PB for short, is a democratic process where community members can decide how to spend part of a public budget. Gives real people power over real money. PB started in Porto Alegre, Brazil in 1989 as an anti-poverty measure that helped to, for example, reduce child mortality by nearly 20%. And since then, it's spread to over 7,000 cities all over the world, being used to make decisions on the state level, city level, county, as well as different kinds of budgets in like housing authorities, schools, and organizations.
And that includes the United States in a remarkably wide variety of settings. Anita Dos Santos gives us a sense of the reach.
That's exactly right. It's happening in small cities, big cities, and like both urban and rural contexts. And I want to make sure that folks understand that really anywhere there's a budget, there is an opportunity to use PB to collaboratively make decisions on how it should be spent. One of the things we like to say is, like, if you can spend it, you can do PB with it. Thinking about like some big cities, the city of Los Angeles has just wrapped up the voting phase of their process. There are also places in the U.S. that have been running PB processes like year after year, like Chicago, which was the first city in the U.S. to run a PB process in 2009, a youth process in Boston that's been running for a few years, as well as a process running out of high schools in Phoenix. And over the past few years, we've also seen some places running PB processes with unique, sometimes one-time sources of funding, like Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Central Falls, Rhode Island, which both used COVID relief funding to do participatory budgeting. And you're right that there are so many other places. If folks are curious, we actually have a map on our website with processes all across North America where you can see, where you can filter by like budget and funding source.
So how does this actually work? As Anita Dos Santos makes clear, no two communities go through the process of participatory budgeting in exactly the same way. But there are common elements. One of the first steps of participatory budgeting is identifying a source of funds to be used for a project. The funds typically come from the public allocation of a portion of an overall budget.
And so after a pot of money has been identified, the first phase is one of the most important, and it's when a community steering committee comes together to write the rules that govern the process. In this phase, they write rules that establish transparency so that everyone knows what the process will look like, what their role will be, and what the process will decide. The steering committee considers every step in the process and designs for equity, meaning that they make decisions that ensure everyone, especially the people in our communities who have been historically left out of democratic processes, can meaningfully participate.
What happens next in many communities is an ideation phase. In other words, a phase during which residents can freely contribute their ideas to improve the community.
So this is the phase that you just mentioned, the idea collection phase. After the rules are written, we enter idea collection. This is where we go out into communities to collect hundreds, if not thousands, of ideas on how to spend a portion of these public funds that we've identified. Typically, the ideas can be collected through a series of community events at locations where people are already located at, like train stations, schools, markets. We can also do this online and through social media. Once those ideas have been collected, we enter the proposal development phase. And so this is where community members working alongside city and agency staff take those ideas and turn them into concrete project proposals based on community need, feasibility, and impact. Once those ideas are distilled into a workable plan, costs are identified. And this work is really important to ensure that all projects that make it onto the ballot can be meaningfully implemented and impactfully implemented. So finally, once we have our ballot, the communities vote. And so in step one, the design committee has established the logistics, such as vote duration and voter eligibility, as well as outreach plans. And depending on the process, voting can last up to a couple of weeks. And one of the primary goals is to ensure that everyone in the community is given an opportunity to have their voice heard and cast a ballot. And so unlike in traditional elections, the steering committee thinks critically about where and how the voting should take place. Similar to idea collection, we can put voting stations at community centers, popular grocery stores, laundromats, a school pickup, you name it. And after voting, it's time to implement the winning projects. And before we start the process again with the, you know, next school year or the next budget cycle, for example, we evaluate how this process went to make improvements for the next cycle.
So that's a condensed version of how participatory budgeting is likely to unfold in any community. But what makes it really work and lead to lasting change? One way to get insight into that is to look at the results.
So first, we see that the projects that actually win in these processes are more reflective of community needs. And so going back to that school example that we mentioned a little bit earlier, in the Phoenix School District, there was a project that won that was a shade structure for students. And a few years before this, they had created a shade structure for students that was far away from where the students were hanging out. It was far away from, you know, a water fountain. And so no one really used it. And in this PB process, the students proposed a shade structure that was in a place that they were already hanging out, had running water. And so, you know, this is an example of a way that actual winning processes are making us spend our budgets more efficiently, because the folks who are closest to the decision are the ones that are being impacted by the decisions. Another example that I'll share in terms of winning projects is in the Seattle process that just wrapped up this past November. Their process focused very heavily on community safety, and some of the winning projects included 24/7 public bathrooms and funding for a project that would provide trained mental health professionals to serve as first responders. And again, these are ways that folks that are being impacted are choosing what they think is most impactful.
And here, Anita Dos Santos makes the very important point, which is that when participatory budgeting is carried out according to best practices, it has the potential not only to fund individual projects that match community needs, but it has the possibility of leading to lasting systems change. And that includes more effective and equitable public spending overall.
One example of this is how PB processes can communicate to elected officials what communities value and what's needed. In the first few years of the New York City processes, a really frequently suggested project was air conditioning in New York City schools. And eventually, this was suggested so many times that folks said, you know, this shouldn't be something that we only win when we put it on a PB process ballot. And eventually, the city council passed a multi-million-dollar bill to implement air conditioning in schools all across the city. And this happens because, again, I feel like a broken record, the people closest to the situation knew what they needed. But then the second key piece is that the city council listened and did something about it.
Another significant impact highlighted on the participatory budgeting project's website is a stronger civil society. As stated there, people are learning democracy by doing, and they are doing it within the context of more transparent and accountable relationships with their own public institutions that are funded by tax dollars and operate in the service of the citizens that pay those taxes.
This means that PB provides a path for our communities to first be more equipped to participate in civic processes that go beyond voting in regular elections, right? Sometimes when we talk about civic engagement or participation, we think, oh, voting. But this includes things like rezonings in your community that can have multi-million dollar level impact, participating in community boards, and for folks who are traditionally left out of like their PTA processes and even student government. And I think when they do participate, these people are demanding more power and more excited to participate. Ultimately, PB is there creating a path for people to see that, oh, there are decisions being made that impact my life, and I can be involved and I should be involved. I think that is what we think about in essence, in real brief, when we're talking about what a stronger civil society looks like.
And another important impact participatory budgeting can have is to encourage and train new community leaders. That's why participatory budgeting projects welcome the engagement of young people, not only for their direct input on how public money could be spent, but also to give them access to training in the wide range of skills it takes to effectively organize around community empowerment, and to give them access to a vision of what's possible when they do.
I hope that young people will learn that when you use your voice, things change. And when we use our voices together, a lot of things can change, and we can build a world that is more and more for us. And when I say us, I mean, more and more for the people that our U.S. society was not designed for. There's a lot of noise and a lot of different sources of information that are eager to tell us, don't make too much of a fuss or don't cause a problem here. But I think that I hope that young people see that when they open their mouths and when they speak, they build a world that is more supportive of them and of the people that they love and their communities.
So, returning again to the question of how to design and implement a participatory budgeting project, one that can live up to that kind of vision, we asked Anita Dos Santos how she would define a successful process and what it would take to get there.
And I would say that a successful process would be one where all people who are touched by the process, whether they are someone who dedicated a lot of time to it as a volunteer in that steering committee or in that proposal development phase, for example, or whether they just attended an idea collection event or a voting event, all of these people feel that their participation was fruitful, impacted their lives and the lives of those in their community, both through the connections and the relationships that they build and the eventual implementation of the projects that will be beneficial to the entire community. And so, in essence, what makes a PB process successful is a systems change that it brings. And so we're looking for PB to impact how decisions are made long term, not just to get one amazing winning project. What are some things that lead to success? The first one that I would say is that at every step of the process, we are designing for equity and asking who needs to be in the room, who has not been here, and how do we bring them in? And are we going out and inviting them and ensuring that when they do come, that this is accessible to them, meaning that it's easy and interesting to participate. And to ensure that, we might do things like translating written materials or providing live interpreters at our events, providing childcare, reimbursement for transportation, food at our events, and those kind of things. We can also do this by compensating our community members for their time as a way to honor and value their lived experience that they bring, using their experience to inform the projects that are needed in their community. And it also supports their ability to be present. The second thing that I would say that is a key factor that leads to success is a commitment to iteration, to trying something new when the old way doesn't work, and to adjusting and adapting and being nimble along the way. And yes, if you're thinking that this probably takes a long time, you are right. This does take longer than the usual way that we make decisions. And this is part of it too, right? An acceptance that this is a new way to do democracy that will take more time and energy, but that ultimately leads us to beautiful outcomes like money being spent more equitably and efficiently when the people closest to the issues can make decisions about what to do about those issues.
Of course, access to tools and resources is essential to any participatory budgeting process, and that is the goal of the Participatory Budgeting Project, to offer exactly that.
So on our website, we have tons of resources. The first one that I want to shout out is one that I've already mentioned, but it's a map where you can see processes all across North America in case you're curious if there's been one in your city or maybe in a city super nearby. There are tools to support you in advocating for, implementing, and even evaluating PB processes. We also have specific tools for schools as well as organizations that want to do PB internally. And we have a blog where we share updates and insights from the world of participatory budgeting and participatory democracy. And so feel free to check out any of these resources if you're interested in advocating or implementing a PB process. And if you want more support, you can also reach out to us on our Contact Us page. Our website is participatorybudgeting.org.
That was Anita Dos Santos, Advocacy Manager at the Participatory Budgeting Project. You can reach them at participatorybudgeting.org. For Monday Morning QB, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Diversity in country music has been a hot topic for the past couple of months since Beyoncé dropped her latest album with a couple country music hits. Some country music artists seeking popularity are at the center of the limelight since being featured on the Beyoncé album. Reporter Asia Beckham spoke with Santi Elijah Holly, a music critic, to discuss Beyoncé's latest and what's evolving in the country music genre.
I'm a journalist and an author. My journalism and my writing covers sort of the intersection of music and culture and art, social issues, things that are happening today, also just history and sort of connecting all those threads, introducing people to little-known histories and little-known stories and showing how that's all part of, you know, the culture that we live in and society that we live in, and just, you know, trying to introduce people to different ideas and subjects.
So, Santi, what's your take on Beyoncé's latest album entitled Cowboy Carter?
Yeah, now that we've had some time to sit with it, I listened to it a lot so far, and I'm going to keep listening to it. There's so much there. I mean, it's such an ambitious project, and it's so comprehensive about in different musical styles that she's incorporating into her songs, into her lyricism. And there's just a lot that she pulls in from sort of the history of music, you know, from across all different genres. And myself and a lot of other folks were sort of anticipating more of a country album. And that's sort of the way that we made ourselves think that it was going to be a country album, even though she'd said from the beginning, this isn't a country album, it's the Beyoncé album, but we still really wanted it to be a country album. I mean, she's got the cowboy hat and everything, and so we really wanted it to be a country album. She's got Texas Hold'em, which is, you know, definitely a country song, but the rest of the album is bigger than country. You know, it's bigger than country music. As we think about country music, I mean, country is pretty broad and expansive itself, but Cowboy Carter is just beyond that. You know, she's pulling in old rock and roll, old Chitlin' Circuit rock and roll, American Bandstand, folk music, Americana, pop, trap music, all this stuff to sort of create, as she says, told us all at the beginning, this is the Beyoncé album. I think it's a great album. I just am accepting really that it's not a country album as I was, you know, personally hoping for. And I know a lot of us were really excited about that idea of Beyoncé's country album, but I don't think this is quite, you know, this is as country as she's been, but it's not what I would consider a country album, just because it has country elements and country songs on it.
You personally know some of the featured artists. What's your reaction to hearing them, and what's the best track for you?
I'm not going to get into the best track for me personally. There's so many that just hit different depending on the slow ones. I'm acquainted with some of the artists that were guested on there. Willie Jones, he's on the song Just for Fun, the slow sort of ballad song, and he just sounds so good. I think he adds so much to that song. Just even though he has this brief verse, his voice comes through just in a way that, you know, he's always had this really deep, rich voice. And he's a guy that's also done R&B and country music and rock music and combined all those elements. He's been doing it for years. So I was, of course, excited to learn that he was on, you know, this album. But also Tanner Adell, Raina Roberts, I've been listening to them for years. So, you know, they're on Blackbird. And I've spoken to, you know, some of these folks who told me they're getting so much more attention now. Before, they were, you know, slowly building their fan base, you know, stream by stream and video by video and TikTok by TikTok. But now it's just like out of control. So obviously all you got to do is just have Beyoncé co-sign. And now that it's blowing up, which is great to see. And beyond those folks that is mentioned, I think it's sort of covering a lot of people. A lot of folks are now sort of looking into other artists who are maybe not given the same sort of attention that they could be getting, but now they're starting to get that because of this, you know, the Beyoncé effect, the Cowboy Carter effect.
Before releasing this album, the act two of her much anticipated trilogy, Beyoncé said this is not a country album. This is a Beyoncé album. Beyoncé says that the project was born out of an experience that she had years ago where she did not feel welcome, adding that it was very clear that she was not. She's the first Black woman with the number one single on the Billboard's Hot Country Songs chart, holding the number one spot. What's the public reaction to Beyoncé's comments of feeling unwelcome and the overall body of work, collaborations with big name artists, and reaching the top of the country song chart?
This album as sort of a answer to that, because I think people have since then have started to sort of become a little more enlightened about what's going on with Black folks and country music. With her statement, saying that this was born out of that experience. What she does is very intentional. You know, she's very thoughtful and she crafts her art, you know, with great intention, with great consideration. And she also, you know, I mean, and I mean this with no grudge against her, but she has a little bit of vendetta, you know, against some folks who, you know, thought that they could gatekeep her music and who also was welcomed into certain scenes and certain industries. And this was her answer to that, not being at the top of the country music charts, but it's her just sort of saying, you know, you come at me, this is how I'm going to respond. I'm going to respond to this and I'm going to take it over. And she's very good at just sort of crafting this narrative of this is my art and you can't tell me what to do. So I'm going to do it. And then I'm going to take it over and be the best at this particular, you know, at this moment. It's funny to see, it's amusing just to see how, what she did and how she sort of just took this moment, this, you know, really ugly incident that happened and used it to not just her advantage, but to sort of lift up other folks too. You know, she's not really somebody who's out there going to lift up people and, you know, and sacrifice of her own art, but just by even starting this conversation like we're having right now, like we've been having, you know, since this album was announced, just by virtue of saying country music and having a country single has really, I feel like, you know, it's changed forever because of this incident. So yeah, it was an ugly incident that happened, but she made this great, you know, artwork from it. And I think we're also going to start to see some more changes, you know, unfold as time goes on.
When the first two singles were released, Beyoncé fans called country music stations to demand the tracks be played. Can you talk about the country music industry and why country fans gatekeeping who is allowed to appear on country charts, refusing to play certain artists on country radio or displaying Confederate flags at prestigious country music festivals? Some festivals have issued bans.
I want to say country music only really maybe the last decade, last maybe two decades. This is relatively recent in country music's long history, over 100 years, has become much more nationalistic. I mean, especially nationalistic, but also, like you said, the Confederate flags, which doesn't actually go together. You can't be like a nationalist and be a Confederate. But the idea of country music being like a white good old boys club is sort of a recent thing. Happened, really took off after sort of September 11, 2001. And since then, it's sort of gotten become more and more so like that. So sort of not welcoming to other folks, or at least where other black and brown folks don't feel as welcome in these spaces, obviously. So of course, there is this, you know, taking sides. I mean, like country music has always sort of felt like you had to take a side. Like, I'm either with country or I'm with R&B and I'm with hip hop or whatever. You can't really be on both sides. And so this, when people are calling in to radio stations and demanding, you know, that people play Beyoncé, people play Texas Hold'em, it's sort of just saying, let us in. You know, it's not even saying, you know, give respect to Beyoncé, because we love Beyoncé. It's saying, look, this is a, you know, a country song. And of course, we've been here before with Lil Nas X, the Old Town Road. Country stations didn't want to play it because it didn't have the, quote, country elements to it. Country elements are becoming more and more, you know, country music is using 808s and like drum machines and samplers and sequencers. You know, some of the top artists are using all these instruments and tools that have been historically or been in, you know, recent years used primarily for R&B and hip hop and trap. So I think people are saying, look, if country artists are using these instruments and these tools to create what you still call country music, how is it that a black woman, a black person can use these same tools, make a country song just as country as any other country performer, and it doesn't qualify? You know, obviously there's something wrong here. Look, the line between so-called quote unquote black music and white music, or at least country music and R&B, trap, hip hop, soul music, you know, those lines are sort of, that line's blurring, and these artists are pulling from each other's elements. And so to even say, you know, like who's allowed to be played on a country radio station, who's allowed to be played on this station or whatever, like just like, there's no argument to be made for that. You know, if it's a country song, it's a country song. You know, we can't really define what it is right now because it's not the same country that we've had, you know, for 100 years, but that's the point. And so we really have to rethink why, you know, what is it? If it's not, you can't easily say it's because of the instrumentation or the country elements, then really you're just saying it's race. And then so that's, I think, why people are now sort of like coming out and saying, look, we don't even like country. We don't listen to your country music station, you know? So it's not even a matter of that. It's just saying, don't tell us, you know, that this isn't country when we know, you know, damn well it's this country. It's just as country as anything else that you play on your station.
What has African culture contributed to the country music genre?
But American music really wouldn't exist, country music especially, without the contributions of African-Americans in the early turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century. Just, I mean, playing blues music, field hollers, you know, church music, gospel, all this sort of comes together and people are playing music together and learning from each other just like we're doing now, but they're doing it in a way that's, you know, you're on the ground and you're playing instruments. Early blues musicians influenced early country and Americana and folk music. I mean, it's all the same chords, same stories. The Carter family was influenced by a black guitar player named Leslie Riddle. Hank Williams, you know, the Shakespeare of country music, was influenced by a black guitar player named Rufus Payne, Rufus T-Top Payne. You know, Johnny Cash was influenced by a black guitar player. The history of the guitar, the banjo itself, goes back to Africa. I mean, we can look at all this and sort of see that this has been an evolution of black and white musicians learning from, borrowing from each other, exchanging ideas. And so, you know, we get to get to a point right now where that's still happening. But I think we're such more rigid in what we consider a genre, you know, like the categories and boxes, where in early 1900s, there wasn't that same sort of rigidity. So black musicians, guitar players, singers, folk singers, were, you know, influencing white guitar players and singers who were just coming up. And that's sort of been the case for a long time. And, you know, in the 60s and 70s, we saw black soul musicians and R&B singers doing country albums, you know, from Ray Charles to Tina Turner, Solomon Burke, Esther Phillips, Bobby Womack were doing country albums. And, you know, there wasn't any controversy. It was just sort of known, well, yeah, this is good American music, and why not, you know, make a country album? So, yeah, right, I think it's just recent that we sort of have convinced ourselves that it's been, they used to be different, but really it's just today that we've put ourselves in these boxes and said, you know, who can and cannot record certain genres of music.
Santi, what's your take on the future of country music?
I'm really excited about the future of country music. I mean, I've been listening to country for years, but I'm also, you know, I grew up with hip hop and trap and, you know, soul music, old school soul music. And I just love to see, I mean, really what I'm most excited about seeing in country music is this sort of blend of genre and of styles. And like the people I've been listening to a lot lately is Willie Jones, Rashad, you know, this young cat coming up who's really making just like exciting sort of fresh music. Tanner Adele, of course, Raina Roberts. All these folks are just, you know, sort of creating something new. I mean, like we hear on Cowboy Carter, these folks have been doing it for years. So now that we have sort of a spotlight on them, that they have encouragement and actually, you know, more listeners and everything, I think it's going to just open up this whole world of people who are experimenting with the genre, with music, bringing in folks who haven't really felt comfortable or safe in these spaces, in country music spaces. And that, you know, that's only makes music better. That only makes any art better is when you open it up to other folks to sort of bring their background and their history and their experiences to the music and to the art. That just makes it all the more better. So I'm really excited to see, you know, as it goes on, yeah, we all benefit from new experiences and new stories and new artists who are bringing something new to the field. I'm excited just to see what happens, you know, after this.
That's Santi Elijah Holly, a journalist and essayist covering music, books, and culture. Thanks for coming on, Santi. Now let's turn it over to an up-and-coming country musician. Let's tune in now.
My name is Rashad, and I'm a country artist from Willacoochee, Georgia.
Rashad, what's your take on the Beyoncé album, and are any of your friends on it? You're a musician. Who do you know?
I think the album's fire. I got a couple friends on there, Shaboozy and Willie Jones. I actually just did a tour with Willie I want to say it was last year. We did the Sticks and Swamps tour, and I didn't even know they was on it until it came out. Like, nobody told me. But I get it. Like, you really can't say nothing about that. But yeah, it was dope. I thought the album was dope. And when I heard it, it was like a mix of everything. And I like how she took like country and made it her own. But I think my favorite song off that album was probably Yaya. Yaya's fire.
So growing up, who were some of the country artists that you listened to, whether that be on the radio or a festival that you and your family attended? What was that sort of first artist or particularly a first song that you heard and fell in love with?
As for musical inspirations, I'm inspired by everything. I was inspired by Lil Bow Wow to do music in general, but it was like Jason Aldean and Luke Bryan and Darius Rucker that influenced me to do country music. And I feel like in my music, I draw from all kinds of inspirations. Like, I draw from my hip hop influences like Tupac, Lil Wayne, J. Cole. And then on like some of my rock tune stuff, I'm pulling from influences like Ice Nine Kills and Falling in Reverse. But I'm just inspired by everything. And I just pull all my inspiration together and make it me. The first country song that I remember liking was Sweet Thing by Keith Urban. My daddy, I think he was playing radio. I don't even remember where I heard it. I just remember I heard that song. And that's when I was like, okay, like country music ain't that bad, because initially I didn't like it. But after I heard that song, I still didn't get into it. But it wasn't until I was like, my mama worked in the lunchroom. Me and my sister were sitting there, lunchroom before school with her. And I would flip through the channels, and I landed on CMT. And around that time, it was like Florida Georgia Line, Jason Aldean, Luke Bryan, Darius Rucker, and Hunter Hayes. And that's what really got me listening to country music. And so, yeah, I guess like all of those, like Keith Urban, Jason Aldean, that's some of the first country music I listened to.
Rashad, what's your experience been like being welcomed into the country music genre, stages, festivals? What's that been like?
For me, the experience has been fine. Like when I'm going to writes and in studio sessions and reaching out to people for collabs, like me personally, I don't get treated any differently.
What's your process like of creating music? Sort of walk me through, you know, your best song. How was that song created?
I'd have to say my best song. That's probably Shoebox Money. Because I could say For the Streets, because that was the first song I ever wrote and produced by myself. But Shoebox Money, that's my like life story in that song. And with that song, it's like I wanted to make something like the kind of music that I grew up on, the kind of country music I grew up on. Sometimes I'll already have a title. Sometimes I'll have a track. And, with Shoebox Money, I had the title. Yeah, I already had the title. And I wrote that one with Jordan Fletcher. And I told him, the title I had, but I didn't know exactly how I wanted it to be. I just know I wanted it to be a story. And I told him I wanted to make it honky-tonk. And he knew exactly what I was going for. And we just went in and wrote the thing.
Let's give it a go. Shoebox Money by Rashad.
Well, I started off early. I was cutting grass. I was throwing suds on my neighbor's Cadillac. Dinner time came and I was hauling scrap. About dead tired by the time I got back. Had a couple fresh 20s burning holes in my pocket. I threw them in the closet in an old shoebox. It didn't have much in it. It did me better than the shoes in them. I pinched them pennies all summer long. Then one day they'd all be gone. Save up a bunch of 20s, 10s, and 5s. And throw it all at one time. No, I didn't have to need it. Got it if I want it. Spending every bit of that shoebox money. Well, a few years later, as the story goes, I heard some playing on the radio. It made me want to go and buy a microphone. I sat down and wrote my first country song. I didn't really need to think too much about it. Just went through the closet, pulled the shoebox.
That's country musician Rashad and his song, Shoebox Money. I'm Asia Beckham for Monday Morning QB.
And that's our show for today. Rest in peace and power, Askia Muhammad. Thanks to our engineers. I'm Chris Bangert Drowns.
And I'm Sue Goodwin. Thank you for listening and supporting Jazz and Justice Radio in the nation's capital.
The best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. Let's welcome music royalty, The Whispers, performing all their classic songs for two big shows on Friday, April 26th at 8:30 p.m. and again on Saturday, April 27th at 8 p.m. Also coming is Trouble Funk, featuring go-go legend Big Tony, celebrating his birthday by performing all their go-go classics on Friday, May 3rd at 9 p.m. And on Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalimar, for two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. The Whispers on April 26th and 27th, Trouble Funk featuring Big Tony on May 3rd, and Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
WPFW is looking for a new place to hang our hats and microphones. And we're betting that members of WPFW's In the Know listening community, folks like you, may know of spaces where we might make our new home. Have you walked past or know of a cool space that appears to be for lease? Hit us to it. Know of something that's not yet on the market? We're all ears. Your station for Jazz and Justice requires 2,200 square feet of space in Washington, D.C. or immediate environs. Metro accessible with nearby parking. We value your suggestions and observations as we embark on this vital mission. Email your tips to wpfw.lsb.relocation@gmail.com. And thanks for all you do to nourish and sustain WPFW, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice. Bye.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Still, it's a real good bet. The best is yet to come.
Hi, this is Robin Holden, the proprietor of Robin's Place. Every Friday evening from 7 until 10 p.m., Robin's Place is a mythical entertainment center consisting of four floors. On each floor of Robin's Place, we have rooms that are named after people who I think are icons in music, theater, and literature. We have the Nancy